It's your local Miskin Radio, and as you listen to this, I've made my way into London's West End. I'm at the bottom of Haymarket at the Theatre Royal, a place that's steeped in history. The first production took place here nearly 300 years ago in 1720. But right now, it's playing host to Harvey, a Pulitzer Prize-winning play by the American playwright Mary Chase. I'm joined by one of the stars of the show, someone we hail as a Gravesend success story, Sally Scott. Hi, Sally, how are you?
Hello, I'm very well, thank you.
You were born in Gravesend, I'm right in saying.
I was, yeah. I was born in Gravesend Hospital, and my brother was too, so we were both born there.
I've asked that question once before to somebody else and was trying to find out what part Gravesend had played in their career, and they said, well, actually I was born in Gravesend, but then my parents got me out of there as soon as they possibly could.
No,
did you spend much time there?
We lived in Higham, so I lived in Higham until I was six, and my parents were both teachers. My dad taught in Gillingham, I think. The school, he was head of PE, and the school, I think, changed its name. It was something Manor, Upbury Manor, I think, school. And my mum taught at Shorn Primary School. So my brother and I went to school in Higham. Yeah, I left Kent when I was six, but I was there until then. It wasn't an immediate escape.
Shorn is a lovely place. There's the country park there, and that's a story for another time. But I'm very keen to know, having left Gravesend, which clearly had a big influence on your future success, but how did you get into drama?
In a bit of a roundabout way, actually. I'd kind of always done drama, if that's the way of saying it. My family moved to Oxfordshire. My mum's from Newcastle, my dad's from London, but my family moved to Oxfordshire, and I went to the Oxford School of Drama with my neighbour. We used to go to kind of weekly classes when I was young, and then I sort of never met anyone that was an actor. I went to the theatre all the time, but I didn't know any actors. I wasn't sort of exposed to it at all, and so I went to do English at university. And then at uni, there was just so much drama going on that I did hundreds of productions. We'd do sort of four or five shows a year and then tour all summer and that kind of thing. And I started to meet people who wanted to be actors. And then when I graduated, I still kind of didn't quite have the guts to do it. So I thought, oh, what do I do? And I did started doing an MA. And as soon as I started doing the MA, I thought, oh, that's not what I should be doing. I should be trying to act. So I hired a space at RADA with some friends and managed to persuade a director to direct us and put on a show, and got my first agent through that, and then kind of worked my way up. So a roundabout way. Most people either have family in the business or went to drama school. It was a bit of a slow route, but it's sort of paying off.
It's something you really have to give your all to, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. You do, and what's frustrating, I guess, is that at any moment it could change and you just don't know. And so I guess people give up when they could be on the, you know, absolute cliff edge or brink of sort of something turning their way. And it is just, there are things that help and hinder you, but really the thing you can't do without is luck, and there's not much you can do about that. You just have to at some point be the right person in the right room at the right time, and then it kind of swings your way. So it's a bit of a, you know, you can prepare all you like for a job, you can do the best audition, but if you don't look like the person who's already cast to play your brother or something like that, then it's gone before you even know, you know. So it's quite precarious, but it's definitely fun.
You talk about having, I suppose, the guts, the confidence to make that as a career choice. Do you remember what the turning point was where you said, actually, yes, I am going to go for this?
Yeah, I think it was friends of mine, actually, because leaving drama school, I'd always been quite academic and things, and I started doing an MA in Italian art because I thought, oh, maybe I'll sort of work in the art world somehow. I'd done some work experience, and it sort of struck me that in an auction house, it was nothing to do with the art, it was all about money. And so I was thinking, oh God, well, that's not what I was thinking. And then friends of mine started to go to drama school, and I was thinking, right, I've got to try, I've got to give it a go. It was their bravery, really. So it was, secondary, I got it through them.
Are you sure it wasn't a giant rabbit? Because, of course, that's what the play Harvey is about.
Yeah. No, it wasn't. It wasn't a giant rabbit. But had Harvey been there at the time, he might have encouraged me.
So we may be running a bit ahead of ourselves, but Harvey is the title of the play. Can you tell me a little bit more about that play?
Yeah, it was a famous film. It was originally a play. I think sometimes people a surprise by that. It was a famous film with Jimmy Stewart that I think he won the Oscar for, and the actress whose name I can't remember who played Maureen Lipman's part, Vita Simmons, won an Oscar as well. It was a big success. But it was originally a play, an American play by Mary Chase. It was written in 1945, and 44 maybe, first performed in 45 on Broadway. So just at the end of the Second World War. And it centres on this character, Elwood P. Dowd, in America, who has sort of given up on reality. He has a line where he says, "I wrestled with reality for most of my life and I finally won out over it." So he sort of makes a what seems to be a conscious decision rather than an unconscious one to spend most of his time in the company of an invisible rabbit, 6'3.5" white rabbit, as you do, called Harvey. And so the play, it's got elements of farce. It sort of centres around a mistaken diagnosis on who the person is that needs treatment for what we seem to be. My character, the nurse, works in a sanitarium, and what the sanitarium seems to be classing as a case of madness. So is Elwood mad, or is his sister, who's come to tell us about it, is she mad? And there's a sort of, you know, various kind of farcical elements that happen as we get things wrong. So on the surface, it's a farce, but it's more than that. It doesn't sort of just play out as a farce. It's more complicated because I think it is... Oh, it's hard. It's asking quite important questions, I think, about mental health and the treatment of mental health and that sort of thing, and about companionship and... values, I think, about where we place our values. But it also, even though it has all these serious concerns, I think it's fair to say, and I don't mean this in a light way, but I think it's fair to say that the point of it at the time in which it was written was also escapism, because there was so much kind of horror. And I think Mary Chase was saying that this person has found a way to get through that. And if that's what they choose, then who are we to sort of say that that's not the way to do it? So I think that's probably the main thrust of it, if that makes any sense.
It does. I mean, I was struck by seeing the play last night, and on one level it is very light-hearted, but if you choose to do so, you yeah. can dig very much deeper into it.
Yeah.
And here we are in a theatre where you are every day creating some kind of alternative reality.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think, you know, that can be one of the many reasons why people would come to the theatre to be taken out for a few hours of the concerns that they have, and, you know, to not have to function on the level at which they function for the rest of the day. So I hope that that's what it does. I hope it also kind of encourages people to look at the values that Elwood chooses. He has a line when he says about his mother told him, "You have to be oh so smart or oh so pleasant." And he recommends pleasant. So he has these lovely kind of epithets that I think, even though... I mean, it might seem clichéd as I explain it. It's just sort of not somehow. The story is kind of specific enough to carry it along. So I think it does make you kind of reassess, or I hope it does. And things like... I mean, it doesn't go heavy on the mental health question, but at the same time, you know, it's true to say that now in 2015, mental health is still a stigma, and here we are in 1945 throwing people into baths of cold water and electrocuting them because we don't know what to do, and it's a stigma, and the reason that it's a problem for Maureen's character is because she's losing friends over it, because it's a social problem for her. And so I think, yeah, it's kind of surprisingly relevant. It's a period piece, but it's definitely not dated. I think that would be fair.
Tell me a little bit more about your character, the nurse.
Nurse Kelly, well, she's the only female character that we see who works in the sanitarium. There's another character she refers to called Miss Dunphy. So there is another lady working there. And she's sort of contending with sort of, I don't know if you'd call them misogynistic. I suppose you sort of would, but then again, it's of the time. So, you know, the attitudes to women in 1945, I suppose, would be perhaps misogynistic now, but perhaps not seen in that light then. So she's kind of highly professional, highly efficient, and she's kind of up against it. She's sort of she's having to persuade these Dr. Chumley and Dr. Sarnison, the two men, about her instincts, really, that she tends to get it right. I would say this, but she tends to get it right most of the time, and they tend to take a while to catch up, but they're sort of condescending in the meantime. So, yeah, it's the sort of subplot of the play, her and Dr. Sanderson, who have a sort of coming together that's still, open-ended, but a kind of coming together throughout the story.
In a way, your character is one of the most level-headed and perhaps with the most uncomplicated of lives in the play.
Yeah, well, ooh, uncomplicated. Maybe an uncomplicated story. I mean, she's in the right place at the right time and things like that, but I think she's kind of got various struggles going on. So, she's fighting sort of her professionalism and her interest in the doctor, and she's does a bit of a balancing act. But yeah, I'd say she is definitely one of the most level-headed.
And is that a reflection of real life? Was that a part of the casting?
Oh God, no! I wish it was. Yeah, I could learn from her. No, alas, not.
Was it a tough decision to take on the role when you were offered it? Was it an easy decision to make?
An easy decision. I was doing another job at the time, actually. I was doing King Charles III that was at the Wyndhams, a new play by Mike Bartlett that actually at the weekend at the Olivier's won the Best New Play, and which we're going to Broadway with in September. So I was playing Diana, Princess Diana, in that in the evening and rehearsing this during the day, which was tough, actually, really tough. I mean, obviously, nothing like as difficult as many people's jobs, but was a challenge to do. But no, I was really thrilled to do it and to have the chance of coming in here because it's such a beautiful theatre and I hadn't worked here before and I'd seen lots of things here, but it's a lovely place to work.
This production started off in Birmingham, didn't it? Were you part of that original team?
Yes, yeah, we all are. And it's a Birmingham Rep co-production with the Theatre Royal Haymarket. And Birmingham, again, I hadn't worked at the Rep, and it's a hugely impressive place. They have an amazingly diverse arts programme. Everything's done in-house, so they have these vast kind of warehouse spaces where they built the set and that kind of thing. So that was a great place to work, because even though, like I said, this is more of a period piece, they balance that with really sort of intimate kind of cutting edge stuff there. So it was lovely working there. And then we had a mini tour. We had a week in Malvern and a week in Richmond, and then we came into the Haymarket.
Because the set really is something quite amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, the set's incredible. It has these two revolves that change from Vita's home to the sanitarium back and forth, and then in the interval into the bar. I have to say, I've got no idea how they tore that. I've got no idea how the crew moves that around and sets it up. I wouldn't know where to begin. But yeah, it's a beautiful set. The sort of set you probably don't see that often anymore. You know, often now productions are sort of minimal or abstract, and it's not. It's a kind of, yeah, it's a sort of full working space.
It starts off in an amazingly sumptuous drawing room, I suppose,
yeah,
you'd call it, with a
books
fireplace.
And paintings and a chaise longue, and yeah, and then in the sanitarium there are sort of, again, like books and desks and paintings, and then the bar has got all the tables and stools and bottles and mirrors, and yeah, it does. It's kind of extraordinarily detailed to keep swapping between, but effortlessly quick, you know, it just comes round on the revolve.
I couldn't imagine how that would transfer between different theatres. Was it a big thing for you, though, transferring from Birmingham, then touring, then coming here to the West End?
It's strangely, I've actually never toured before, and it's very odd, because I think I thought that it would feel really different, and you'd sort of find yourself just starting the scene and not even really knowing which part of the country you were in. It's sort of odd that because that stays the same, because the size and everything is consistent, you're sort of always in the same playing space. So, and because when you look out, you really only see darkness, so you don't really see the size or shape of the auditorium itself, so you've just got your playing space on stage, and because that's consistent, I suppose it wasn't really, and it was lovely being in those places. It was great being in Birmingham, it's a great city, and walking in Malvern, and then Richmond was sort of being back home. So yeah, it was lovely, it was really nice.
I was really intrigued seeing the play and particularly listening to the dialogue, because as you say, it is a period piece, it's set in the United States, and I wondered initially whether that would mean the accents would be exaggerated or whether it would maybe even be moved to a different place. But listening, it sounds like a lot of care has gone into the accents, both in terms of the period and the location.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's set in Illinois. We had an accent coach who we worked with. I suppose if you were an American watching it, I'm sure there'd be all sorts of things you'd pick up about it in the same way that you would, you know, if you were watching them do a production of Importance of Being Earnest or something. And I guess that we can only be so accurate in terms of what accents were like at the time, and also the intent of that, not wanting to kind of hinder the accessibility of the play now by doing too much of a sort of stilted, you know, if you were doing a kind of Bombs Over London accent for 1940s London, you know, I mean, there's only so much of that that I think is fitting. And I guess it's also true to say, this is probably just a get-out clause, but there's no reason why people in that town at that time couldn't have come from other parts of America. So whilst there is a sort of idea towards a kind of unity of accent, I think it's also possible that, for example, Lionel's character, Lionel Hafty plays the taxi driver at the end. I hope this is what Lionel is aiming for, otherwise I'm in trouble. But Lionel has the best accent out of all of us. But I think, to me, it has a New York kind of twang. And I think there's something really nice about associating that with the cab driver, because we just make that connection with yellow cabs and things. So I think there are sort of little ways that people have nudged their accent to fit their kind of backstory. So, yeah, but I think, I'm glad that came across.
You're working with quite a fantastic cast as well.
Yeah, the cast is insane. It's sort of the kind of, Theatre Hall of Fame. Yeah, it's great. It's lovely. And everyone brings different stuff to it. So, obviously, Maureen and James are very well-known and very well-known for comedy. And then Felicity, Amanda, David, Des have sort of worked in, you know, done. I mean, Des has played every role going at the RSC, so they bring a huge amount of experience. And then Ingrid comes from a sort of comedy background, and Youssef, Jack, and I have. Youssef's been at the RSC for a long time, I think. So everyone's sort of bringing different things to it, which is really nice. Yeah, it's a great company.
Had you worked with many of them before?
I don't think I'd worked with any of them before. No, I don't think I had. I'm trying to think now, because once you start working, you realise it's all so interconnected and you've all got lots of the same friends and things. No, I don't think I had. Some of the others have at various points, but no, I don't think I had.
Test of your memory. Because comedy can be quite hard. It's all about timing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's all about timing, and I guess what's hard about that is you kind of rely on the other person having the same idea of what that is, and that's not always the case. I mean, that's just what happens in acting. You know, you might be standing there thinking, yeah, well, I wish you'd just say it like that, because then I can say it. But that's the point. You know, you have to respond to what you're given. So then you might be thinking, that's how I want to say it. But then in reality, the thing that you're given means you have to do it differently. And then you find that actually that works better, or that makes more sense with this, which makes, you know, so you kind of, yeah, you're all bringing different things to it.
What happens next? Because I know the run here finishes on the 2nd of May. And I know there's something else booked in here at the Haymarket beyond that.
Yeah.
So what happens?
So that's it. That's it for Harvey. I don't know. I guess because, the set and everything is so fantastic. I hope that they'll sort of take it on somewhere else or go back on tour. But whether it will be the same people, I guess probably not, because people at this point now start to have other things that they're going on to. And so it's the end of Harvey here on the 2nd of May, but maybe not the end of Harvey per se.
And for you?
I'm going to Broadway in September with King Charles III, which I'm really looking forward to. But until then, I don't know, sort of a kind of four-month void at the moment. So I have to wait and see, which is the nature of it. But hopefully something soon.
If there's something you could say to someone sat at home listening to this that would make them book a ticket and come and see this production before it closes on the 2nd of May, what would it be?
What would it be? I really do think that it's a sort of seems like a slightly kind of pathetic word in a way, but there is just something charming about this production that I think is quite unusual, because the West End, fantastically, from all the subsidised theatres like the Almeda and the National and things, has had a great run of new writing. And so there's lots of really kind of cutting edge stuff, like the Nether and King Charles III and things going on in town. But I would say that as an alternative to that, it's quite unusual to get a play like this or it has been of late. And so, yeah, I just think it's just a sort of joy. So I would just say, if you want to come and see something fun and kind of, yeah, escapist, I think, then come.
Well, Sally Scott, thank you so much. We'll never let you forget that you started off in Gravesend.
No, I don't want to. That sounds awful, doesn't it? When I say I don't, well, I certainly don't mean, you know, escape and kind of, never go back.
I think it was me that used the word escape. But thank you so much, and best wishes. I hope Broadway goes well.
Thank you. Thanks very much.